From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. In the national debate over ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, one question that comes up frequently is about the effects ERA might have on American society, its laws and politics, its traditions in the home and the family. Soundings explored these issues with William Chafe, a social historian from Duke University who's a scholar at the National Humanities Center. Bill, if women are traditionally viewed as the social cement, what becomes of the social structure when women no longer maintain and transmit the values that have been traditionally associated with them?
One of the things that I think we don't often recognize looking back is the extent to which this view of women as full-time wives and homemakers and mothers is really a late 19th century phenomenon. It's a product of the Industrial Revolution, and it's a phenomenon which is limited, for the most part, to white women of the middle and upper class. It does not apply to black women, it does not apply to immigrant women, it does not apply to poor women. So we're talking about something which is, in fact, the exception rather than the rule.
Before the end of the 19th century, in other words, men were equally responsible with women for the transmission of social values.
Perhaps not equally responsible, but significantly involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the notion of women as the indispensable transmitters of these values goes hand in hand with an ideology which justifies their being limited to a place in the home and not permitted to enter into the areas where power is wielded and the political and economic process of the larger society. And I think that there is no inherent reason why women's participation in those processes on an equal basis with men in any way means the society is falling apart. In fact, I suspect it would become a better society because there would be a more equal input in the job market outside the home, in the world of politics outside the home, and in the home itself on the part of women and men together.
Bill, what do you say to the argument that anatomy is destiny?
Well, I think it's a very primitive viewpoint. I think it goes back to a particular moment in psychoanalytic theory and in cultural history and attempts to generalize from that moment to eternity. And I think there's a real problem with that because we know from our anthropological studies and our sociological studies that people in different cultures, different environments, different economic systems function very differently. And that if you were to take that argument seriously, you would basically argue that because at a given moment or series of moments in life when women bear children, they are therefore totally determined in their entire experience by those moments. And that's reductionism of the worst kind, and I think most people would find that simply unacceptable as good logic in today's world. I think beyond that, what it does is to deny our society the magnificent richness of the diversity of its people, of the fact that each of us has different skills, different abilities. Some of us are great cooks, some of us are great scientists, some of us are great writers. And in each one of those categories, there are women and men both. And if we now say that because someone is born with a penis and someone else is not, that they are therefore denied access to all those positions, that sounds to me as though it is not only illogical, but also the height of folly.
Bill, I know that historians don't like to speculate or gaze into crystal balls, but let's assume that ERA is a fact, that it has been passed. There's a good deal of controversy about what ERA would destroy or preserve in our society. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think that ERA has become a very symbolic issue culturally, and that if you actually look at the impact of ERA, it will be an effective way of eliminating some of the remaining discrimination which exists in our legal statutes.
Now, does this mean that ERA is attempting to fix what went wrong in the past, or does it look forward and say, well, we start from this moment on?
No, I think ERA is a statement of principle. And just as we would have in our Constitution a statement that everyone should have equal protection before the laws and that slavery should not exist, both of which statements do exist in our Constitution, we should also have a statement that women and men shall be treated equally before the law.
Well, isn't it implicit then in our Constitution? Why do we need this? Does ERA become redundant in the Constitution?
It is implicit in our Constitution based upon the way in which the 14th Amendment has been interpreted in recent years. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, given the way in which the 14th Amendment was treated and interpreted for the first 75 years of its existence as part of the Constitution, then it is not redundant. In other words, judges change, Supreme Court rulings change, and although at the present moment it is true that the Equal Protection Clause has been interpreted in a manner consistent with the purpose of the ERA, it would not necessarily always be true that that would be the case. And the Equal Rights Amendment, I think, would guarantee that there would be no deviation from that principle of equality of rights.
Well, let's look at a couple of specific issues. What would ERA do to the family? A lot of the churches are saying that, man, if ERA is on the books, the family's going to disintegrate.
Well, I think ERA would do nothing substantively to the family at all. I think it would probably improve relationships within the family because it would provide an important cultural statement that no matter what sex you are within the family, you are as good as the other sex before the law and within the society. I don't think the ERA would do a single thing to the family in terms of its stability, its health, its prosperity. I think that one of the tragedies of the Equal Rights Amendment fight has been the way in which distortions have been introduced and issues which have nothing to do with equality before the law have been made the primary point of contention. What we're really talking about here is, from my point of view at least, the opponents of the Equal Rights Amendment are really opposed to what they see as deep threats to the church, the family, patriotism, honor of age and authority. And they have made the ERA somehow embody all of these undefined but deeply feared threats out there in the society. In some ways, it's very much like the Prohibition Amendment. You know, those who fought for Prohibition were really fighting not just against liquor. They were fighting against foreigners. They were fighting against Catholics. They were fighting against what they saw to be a shift in the cultural purity of their society. I think those who are fighting against the ERA are also fighting against what they see to be a threat to the cultural purity of their values. And I think it's simply tragic that we have all of these forces coming to bear on an issue which I think should really be unquestionable, the issue being that women and men should be equal before the law.
Bill, what do you think ERA would do to American political institutions? You have a lot of women active in politics now. Is it going to be an evolution, or some people are afraid of just an overnight horrendous change in things?
Well, our society doesn't change that rapidly. There were many people who were afraid that when the 19th Amendment was passed and women got the right to vote, it would mean a takeover by women of the political process. And there were some who hoped that would happen, but in fact, nothing like that took place. We have to recognize, I think, that women are not a monolith, nor are men a monolith, that women, like men, come from different classes, different religions, different neighborhoods, and those forces are all very important in the way in which we vote and in who we vote for. So that the votes of women are going to, for the most part, not be that different from the votes of men. And although there may well be some differences in candidates and in the ways in which those candidates function and in some of the underlying values they believe in, there is not the kind of revolutionary change in politics built into this that some people are afraid of. I think that what we have to keep in mind is that when you give someone the right to vote, and when you give someone equality before the law, you're simply recognizing their citizenship. You're not recognizing their supremacy within the political structure.
Does the fact that there are a lot of women opposed to ERA bear on this issue? That some of the most outspoken of the enemies of ERA are women?
Well, I think this is an important issue. I think it's important to recognize, I think, two or three things. First, that the vast majority of women do support ERA, that the vast majority of Americans support ERA.
Now, how do you know that?
Well, the public opinion polls tell us that. The Gallup poll says 75% of both women and Americans generally support the ERA.
If that's the case, Bill, why is it that the state legislatures are ignoring ERA or even trying to reverse previous votes?
I think that the opposition to ERA, as I indicated earlier, has attempted to make it a cultural symbol of everything which they view as subversive and threatening in the society. And the opposition has been very well organized, very effective in its use of propaganda, very effective in its maximization of the support that it has. For example, many fundamentalist evangelical churches have made it a matter of congregational action to oppose ERA. And if you get 150 or 200 people acting together to send mail, to send telegrams, to demonstrate against something, that's very effective and makes a louder noise than the 1,000 people out there who may not be organized, who may not be disciplined, who may not be sending postcards or telegrams. So that a small group with focused energy can be very effective, and with focused resources and money, can be very effective in stopping what a majority would like to see happen. We have, I think, here a parallel to the moral majority. The moral majority does not speak for probably more than 10 or 15% of the population, but the moral majority has done an exceptional job in its use of the media and in its use of mass mailing and in its use of political mobilization to record an influence which is greater than its numbers would merit.
Bill, how are the proponents of ERA going to meet that kind of a challenge?
Well, it's a difficult task to mobilize with the intensity that's necessary and with the focus that's necessary all those people who believe in the ERA and think it should be enacted, but don't necessarily find the time or the energy to put their money on the line or their bodies on the line in service to that cause. It's an interesting phenomenon, I think, that the opponents of ERA have successfully monopolized the way in which the issue is defined in the media. It's defined as something which is going to sanction homosexuality, unisex toilets, women fighting in combat. None of those is the issue. None of those is going to be the consequence of ERA. The issue is equality before the law. But because the minority has been able to define how the issue is perceived, the majority, which supports equality before the law, has been on the defensive and has not been able to make the countercharge. Do you really think that women are less equal than men? Because that's the issue. If you don't believe that, if you believe that women are equal to men, then you have to support the ERA, because that's all it says.
Does the ERA mean that Americans are going to give up their cherished notions of individualism, that we're headed, for instance, toward socialism?
Now, the ERA is simply going to guarantee that women as citizens will have the same opportunities and rights as men as citizens have. In that sense, there's nothing at all inconsistent about the ERA and America's history. Indeed, ERA is not only consistent with, but is a fulfillment of the American promise of equal protection and individual rights. I think that there is a larger question of whether our society can achieve economic and social justice without becoming more cooperative in its values. And that issue, I think, is one which involves the women's movement, goes far beyond it as well, to the general reform movement for a more progressive social system. It took a civil rights movement which transformed the South for pretty much the entire decade of the 1960s before anyone was willing to suggest and act upon basic rights of black citizens under the law. In other words, there are always strong interests that wish to oppose those who are simply seeking their rights under the American creed.
Americans are simply politically passive, is that it?
No, I don't think Americans are politically passive, but sometimes those who wield power do not want to use that power on behalf of justice and equal rights, because it would be more in the interest of the status quo and of preserving the situation as it exists to block those movements for change. Mm-hmm.
William Chafe is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of history at Duke University. At the center, Professor Chafe is working on a project entitled Coming of Age, a Social History of the United States, 1940 to 1980. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. American theater, from its shaky beginnings in the 17th century, has never fully enjoyed acceptance by the American public. Here's an historical overview and explanation from Brenda Murphy, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of dramatic literature at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York.
Well, it mainly has to do with the way theater developed in America because, obviously, America was founded, at least the northern part of America, was founded by Puritans, mostly from England, and they obviously were against any kind of theatrical entertainment. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, at the time America was being founded, the theaters in England were closed under the Cromwell regime, so there really was very little drama.
Well, why the opposition? What was the problem?
Well, they generally thought it was simply immoral, you know, lewd and licentious, as they usually said. And any kind of show or popular entertainment was usually forbidden in the Puritan times.
In the sense that there were better things to do, or?
Yeah, I think that's basically the Protestant ethic idea, as far as the Puritans were concerned. It was a waste of time and a waste of money, and they thought they had better things to do.
But there was nothing about these dramas that were going on in the 17th century or the 18th century that is what we today would call lewd or licentious.
No, I wouldn't say so. Certainly not the kinds of things that they were trying to produce. In fact, the first play that was produced in America was a play called Ye Bear and Ye Cub by an Englishman but living in America named William Darby. And he was arrested and put in prison for writing this play about a bear and a cub in the woods. Well, the only thing we know is that it was about a little incident in the woods, a very Native American subject about a bear and a cub, but it was a show, and that's what they disapproved of.
Brenda, I understand that some producers of drama or actors in drama in the early part of the United States of American history had to present drama under false pretenses. They had to present it, for instance, the example of Othello. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, in most of the northern colonies before the Revolution, there were laws passed against a show and entertainment, similar to those that were in existence in England a century earlier. And there were two theatrical companies in the United States at that time, one Lewis Hallam's company and the other David Douglas's. And both of them had the notion that the way to get around these laws was either to present the play as something else like a musical entertainment or, and this was much better for the Puritans, to present it as a moral lecture. Okay, and Othello was produced in, I think, 1761 in Newport, Rhode Island, as a moral lecture against jealousy. And a beautiful playbill showing, you know, every part of Othello and why it's a moral lecture and so on.
Let me ask you to sketch the evolution of theater in America. I understand that's a big order, but just a thumbnail version. How did it occur?
The beginnings of American drama are very sketchy. Most of the early troops in America were British troops. They put on British plays. The most produced dramatists in America throughout the 18th century were Shakespeare and Sheridan. And then they went on to do melodramas from the German and from the French. The first dramatists that we really talk about as Native American dramatists were really naturalized Americans. Dion Boucicault, for example, who was an Irishman. And I think became an American citizen. I don't want to say that. I'm not quite sure. But he went on to write plays which have an American setting and American ideas, and that's where we begin to talk about American drama.
By American ideas, you mean what?
Dramas about the American conditions. there was a real attempt around 1860, the 1850s and 60s, to try to get local color into drama because the audiences began to respond to that. And the big motivating force here was Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is an incredible phenomenon. Richard Moody's written an excellent article on Uncle Tom's Cabin explaining the phenomenon in the 50s and 60s, which just became a real part of American culture, the Tom Show. But in America, what happened was, in 1852, when it was first adapted, there were four versions of it playing in New York. And from there, it just skyrocketed. During the 1870s, there were something like 80-some companies, I believe, putting on Uncle Tom's Cabin. At its height, there were 500 Tom shows, what they called these traveling companies.
All the same plot, all the same characters?
Well, yeah, the same basic plot, but a lot of different adaptations.
How did it fly in the South, for instance?
Very well, actually. After the war, there was a resurgence in the South of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and there have been attempts to explain why it became so popular in the South. Obviously, the psychological guilt feelings or whatever may have contributed to that, but it became really popular in the South.
So this, you say, is an example of a theatrical production that embodies ideas. Was it artistically successful? It sounds to me like it wasn't.
On a very popular level. What it did for the American theater essentially was to get an audience for the American theater. The problem we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. of the religious opposition to the drama. What happened was that this was such a moral play, and it's extremely moral. I mean, it ends with Uncle Tom and Little Eva ascending into heaven, essentially, usually, and there were choruses singing hymns and all sorts of things. What this did was get the religious audience into the theater. It was now a respectable thing to do. You could go and watch this very moral play. Sure. And people who had thought of the theater as a place for essentially for prostitutes to sell their wares, you know, were now willing to come into the theater. And it just did tremendous things for
the
audience.
Well, what was the direction that American theater took after the success of Uncle Tom's Cabin?
I would say it became much more popular in the sense that the audience, rather than being a handful of upper middle class people, tended to be much more widely distributed. And you especially find this in New York. If you look at in the annals of the New York stage, for example, at the plays being produced in the end of the 19th century, the really popular plays were the plays pitched at the public, melodramas. And then a few American dramatists, like a man named Edward Harrigan and Charles Hale Hoyt, both of whom began to develop American ethnic type characters, and both of whom were really drawing on the life in New York City, the Irish stereotype, the Italian stereotype, the German stereotype, really come from the plays of these people.
Sounds like what the American television sitcoms are up to nowadays.
Yeah, a good analogy.
Drawing on these stereotypes, I guess you'd call
mm-hmm.
them.
Well, both drawing on them and developing them.
Mm-hmm. You've been talking about the popular reception of American drama as it has evolved. What about critical reception? How have the critics shaped American drama, or have they?
Oh, indeed, they have. One of the problems with American drama, especially with the criticism of American drama, is that especially nowadays there's an assumption that American drama begins in 1916 when Eugene O'Neill started to write for the Provincetown Playhouse. And I think if you ask most well-educated Americans to name five dramatists, they will not come up with anybody before Eugene O'Neill. The assumption in America was always up to that point that American drama was an inferior product and that a really good drama is one imported usually from England or an adaptation of a French play. So the assumption was, the critical assumption was that American drama was really not worth criticizing. After O'Neill, especially during the 20s, America had a real resurgence of drama. And some really excellent playwrights during the 20s, like Clifford Odets, Philip Barry, Elmer Rice, Lillian Hellman. In the 20s and 30s, we had some really excellent playwrights in America. But the problem, the critical problem there was that criticism of American drama tended to be focused in more or less popular journals and the New York Times, and so that the direction drama took again was a popular direction, because those are really pretty much popular critics, and whether you produced a play or not tended to be based on whether these critics were accepting it at a fairly popular level rather than at the more literary level, which they were still reserving for Europe, at, you know, Chekhov, Shaw, Ibsen, those were the literary plays. And our American dramatists have never, aside from O'Neill and Miller and Albee, the later playwrights, most of the American playwrights haven't been given that kind of attention.
Mm-hmm. Brenda Murphy is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of dramatic literature at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. At the center, Professor Murphy is working on a project entitled American Realism and Dramatic Form. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, with Soundings. Are Americans headed for a generation of illiteracy? Strong arguments abound on all sides of this issue. Here's a comment from William Dowling, a professor at the University of New Mexico and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
Suppose you woke up tomorrow blind. When you go to bed tonight, you can see the world around you. When you awaken tomorrow, everything has gone dark. I've been reading a good bit recently, and thinking a good bit, too, about literacy in this country. Not simply about the purely mechanical side of literacy, the ability to read and write elementary English sentences, but an older and larger notion of literacy. This other kind of literacy, real literacy I'd call it, means being just as at home in the world of books as you are in what is sometimes called the real world. Real literacy means, for instance, reading at least one book a week, 52 books a year. I don't think many Americans today read one book a week, 52 books a year. But the news, I think, is worse than that. All the evidence we've got suggests that we're raising the first genuinely illiterate generation in the history of the United States. A generation that's very good at watching television, thousands upon thousands of hours of television, that's very good at driving endlessly and aimlessly around the streets in automobiles, that's very good at just hanging around. There's just one thing that they are not good at, and that's reading books. It's easy enough to find villains, the policy of social promotion in the schools, for instance, or the parents. The parents who are never seen by their children reading books themselves, the parents who somehow never manage to suggest that their kids turn off the television and read a book instead, the parents who have never even bothered to take their children on a visit to the public library where the books are, free for the asking. But I don't think we need to look for villains. What we've got on our hands is a genuine tragedy, a generation that in effect has gone blind to a world their grandparents and great-grandparents knew, a generation that is groping around in the world of automobiles and television sets and doesn't even know that there is another world, a better one, a richer one, inside of books.
William Dowling is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at the University of New Mexico.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me for Soundings. How would ratification of the ERA affect American ideals and traditions? some answers and insights, along with a report on American drama and a commentary on literacy in the United States. Please join me this week for Soundings.